Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
I'm waiting for the air conditioning to begin before I stand. That's a barbed comment. Today we do Maurice Maeterlinck, who was Belgian, wrote in French. His dates are 1862 to 1949. So he died about 87. He is slightly earlier than Shaw, but I wanted to end the course on his play rather than on the martyrdom of St. Joan. Maeterlinck wrote about 60 major works of fiction and nonfiction, essays, plays, poetry. He was raised by a conservative, rich, as I say, French-speaking family in Flanders. He went to Catholic school, but it never took. He never became religious. He has a very definitely structured life psychologically. Three phases his life goes in an arc. He starts with gloom and depression. That's his youth, including his marriage. Then he fell in love, and a soaring, benevolent, aspiring, optimistic quality took place. He was transformed psychologically, and that is the period during which he wrote Mona Vana. And then he gradually grew depressed again till he died. So we are doing the happiest and one of the most romantic of his works when we do Mona Vana. There were two women in his life, his wife and his mistress. His mistress is Georgette LeBlanc. She was a famous singer. Their affair was new, and that's what made him blissful. She wanted to debut on the stage, and he wrote Mona Vana for her, and it opened with her in the lead on May 7th, 1902. So that's actually a couple decades earlier than St. Joan. At first, the play was banned in London because Queen Alexandra interpreted the play as saying that virtue and fidelity do not count against human lives. In other words, Mona Vana should never have taken up Prince Ivali's immoral offer just to save a city. This was the destruction of all virtue, fidelity, and morality, and could not be shown in England, therefore. The English were also very upset at the fact that she was naked under her cloak. You see how things have changed. Finally, however, Mona Vana became famous in world repertory prior to World War I. And of course, World War I is the conventional date for the end of the Romantic era in Western history. Prior to World War I, Maeterlinck ranked as the greatest dramatist in Europe. He got the Nobel Prize in 1911. And unfortunately, after World War I, he was gradually but inexorably forgotten. I went to a bookstore in New York City about a year ago. These highly specialized bookstores that exist only in New York, where you can find usually a library on anything, however esoteric. And an old man behind the counter, when I asked him, I said, I'm doing research on Maeterlinck for Mona Vana, and his eyes lit up. He was an ancient man, and he said, I haven't heard anybody ask for that since the 1930s. He said they used to come in all the time for that, but he said, I just haven't heard it for over 50 years. And he suggested that the only place that I would find books on Maeterlinck was the Belgian consulate, which has as its mission to spread Belgian culture in the United States. So I did contact them. They were exceptionally gracious to me. They gave me four or five books from a vast library on Maeterlinck. So New York did live up to the fact that you can find anything there if you know where to look. So I owe my lecture basically to their books. I have a nice quote from Maeterlinck about old age when he was in his 80s. And he said, quote, "I try to be bored so that the last hours of my old age may be longer for me, but they pass more quickly than those of my youth and middle life. It is very difficult to cultivate boredom when one takes to it too late." I always think that implies a nice, active, thoughtful life. Now, as regards Mona Vana, the only preliminary thing we need to know is that the time setting of it is the end of the 15th century. So it's the High Renaissance, about 150 years after the burning of St. Joan. All right, number two, the plot theme of Mona Vana. Well, here again, we're going to just jump in and take a first stab at it. A man wants to sleep with another man's wife. Or even a powerful man wants to sleep with another man's wife. But that leaves us cold, as stated. There's no conflict. There's nothing at stake. She just says yes or no, and that's it. Well, let's try to bring in a third party and make a triangle out of this. A powerful man offers a value to a husband if the wife agrees to sleep with him. Now, this already suggests the husband has a say in what goes on. He is in conflict. He debates whether or not he should let his wife do it. He needs to have an offer made to him. So we have the beginning of a conflict in a situation. Now, of course, you will immediately, unfortunately, recognize in this formulation what movie. Indecent Proposal, which is an indecent takeoff on Mona Vana, where the man offers $1 million to the husband. Now, I didn't see it. I tried to bring myself to see it several times, but there are other movies on pay TV, and I could never actually press the button for that movie. But as I understand from my spies and reporters, the differences are very substantial in plot theme, let alone everything else, to Mona Vana. In the Mona Vana situation, money is not a significant value. Now, in the Indecent Proposal movie, the couple, I gather, have no really desperate problem to which the money would be the solution, except something that's thrown in about saving their house. But basically, as I get it, they have gambling losses they have to make up. If they hadn't gone to Las Vegas, they would have gone about their business as before, and everything would have been okay. So it's a kind of chance situation. Now, contrast that, for instance, with something which is not yet Mona Vana, but much better. A powerful man offers $1 million to save the life of the dying husband if the wife agrees to sleep with him. Here there's a conflict, a real motive, and a real source of temptation and struggle. It's not just $1 million, which, after Clinton, is only worth about $200,000 anyway. However, that is still not a good enough idea for a worthwhile play, let alone a great play. Because what is the motive of the man offering $1 million? Does he have a passion ruling him? Now, an Indecent Proposal, I gather, it's basically a whim. It's a stunt to see what he can get away with, a kind of cynical test of human nature. So the motive is either low and evil or at best spur of the moment. But suppose now that the man who offers the bribe is really in love with her, deeply in love with her, and has been for many years, and he offers $1 million to save her husband's life if she will sleep with him. Now, that is already a better situation. It's still not good enough. Why? It's too callous. If this man is so much in love with her, why does he subject her to this? He wouldn't do it in real life. But now, what novel do you know that is a real variant on just this situation? Yes, We the Living. A woman decides to sleep with a powerful man who loves her in order to save her husband's life. That's a very similar situation. But there in We the Living, it's very clear. The other man mustn't know that she's doing it for the money because he loves her and he wouldn't do it for money. And the husband mustn't know because he's too proud to accept money from his mortal enemy. Now, how could this happen? Well, Ayn Rand figured that that kind of situation could happen only in a dictatorship, because in a free country, the wife wouldn't be reduced to that. So she reached the idea, a woman decides to sleep with the head of the secret police in a dictatorship, a man in love with her, in order to save her husband's life. And that is a great plot theme, made even better when she actually falls in love with the head of the secret police. Now, Mona Vanna is a variant on We the Living. It's basically the same type of plot theme. A powerful man offers an enormous value, not money. It's much too simple to offer $1 million or $1 trillion. Money is just not something that will make a play go. It has to be life or death. That is really the only thing that will make the theater work. A powerful man offers an enormous value to a husband if the wife sleeps with him. This is Mona Vanna now. The motive of the offerer is passionate love of the wife. And the value he offers is not just the life of her husband, but of her entire country. The city-state is of Pisa, which involves about 30,000 people, which will otherwise be annihilated. So now it's even harder for the husband to say no, because his native land is in jeopardy. Now you've got an idea here which really intensifies everybody's conflict. And you see, that is just leagues above the idea, here's $1 million, can I sleep with you? Oh yeah, my house is at risk. I mean, it's insulting to Maeterlinck to have to make a comparison to Indecent Proposal. Now, Maeterlinck had to make real to himself, how could one man threaten a whole country? That's one problem he had with creating this play. And the other was, he needed a context where sexual fidelity is a major issue. So that excluded the 20th century as the setting. Because, especially the later 20th century, because he wrote it right at the turn of the century, but they were already very liberated attitudes in the avant-garde. And essential to his plot is the idea that these two men could not abide the idea that she just sleeps around, as against, you know, the convention on TV today. So basically, he was cut in time frame to the period between the Renaissance and, say, the end of the 19th century, in order to have the attitude that he wanted toward sex. He picked the Renaissance as a setting, because one man could plausibly hold the fate of the entire country in his hands, because those were the city-states. If he's the commander of the invading army, the city is under siege, and he is in love with her, then the only other thing we have to throw in to get the final situation is he is risking his own life to do so. At least that's what he thinks. So he's got a conflict too. All he wants is one night with her. And it looks like she's doomed with the city anyway. She hears rumors about the man. He's a wicked barbarian. Oh no, he's an early Renaissance, highly cultured, literate man. Even her husband's own soldiers say he's strong and admirable. Now you got a situation, see, that's worthy of a great play. Now here's how I would formulate the plot theme now that we've discussed the factors that go into it. So you can take this down. The captain of a besieging army offers victory to a dying city, comma. at the risk of his own life, comma, if the wife of the city's commander spends one night alone with him. The captain of a besieging army offers victory to a dying city at the risk of his own life if the wife of the city's commander spends one night alone with him. Now notice all the things that we have to omit from the plot theme, because they are the story as it develops. They are not the essential action situation. We don't include her answer. Not whether she goes or she refuses to go. That's going to come out when we tell the story. The situation is just she's given the choice. What happens then? We do not most emphatically include that she's lukewarm about her husband. That is something that even she doesn't realize at the beginning. It's part of the story as it develops. We do not include the fact that her husband was hostile to the offer. All we know is obviously there's going to be a conflict here, but what his reaction is going to be, we don't know. And notice, wherever possible, state actions, not emotions, in a plot theme. This is a plot we're talking about, an action situation. So instead of saying a captain of a besieging army madly in love, which is an emotional statement, you say the captain at the risk of his own life, and you leave his action to suggest that he's madly in love. Now, there are plays in which you simply cannot say the plot theme without an emotional word. For instance, I defy you to capture the plot theme of Othello without the word jealous. But wherever you can leave it out, it's better, because our idea is the bare essence of the action situation. All right, and now from this we can, of course, immediately define, as we always do, the main characters and the essential conflict. And here, self-evident, there are three main characters: Prince Ivaldi, Guido, which I learned last night that's how you pronounce it, and Mona Vanna. Mona is like dame or lady or Ms. Her name is not like Joanne Mona Vanna. Her name is Vanna. Now, which of these is the protagonist? Which one of the three? No, it's not Prince Ivaldi. Prince Ivaldi is responsible for what's called the inciting incident. He takes the step that gets the thing started. He incites the action. But thereafter, he has to wait and see what's going to happen. Guido waits throughout to see what's going to happen. Who is it that makes the essential decisions to go or not to go, to love or not to love, to remain faithful to her husband or not? Obviously, the plot-moving figure is Mona Vanna, so the title here is a faithful indication of the protagonist. Marco, of course, the father, is just a go-between philosophic commentator. He's more or less like a Greek chorus, so he's not an essential character. What is the basic conflict between whom? Between the two men. Guido is against it. That's why he has to be offered so incredible a price as the salvation of his whole country. And Prince Ivaldi wants to stake his whole life for it. And of course, everybody has conflict, as in a proper play, derivative from that basic one. Mona Vanna has a clash with Guido as soon as she decides to go. Mona Vanna has a clash with Prince Ivaldi at the beginning, etc. Guido wants to kill Prince of Valley. So they're all interplayed, but it all hinges on their basic conflict over this value. Okay, let us go to three, plot development. Now, this is, again, an eminently logical plot structure, classic plot structure, exactly an Aristotelian beginning, which is what we're calling the establishment, a rise to the climax, that's what Aristotle called the middle, and then a resolution, suspenseful, drawn-out resolution, and that is what Aristotle called the end. And here is very neat, three acts, three parts. Act one is the basic situation established. What we have to get is Prince Valley's offer, and then the conflict between Vanna and Guido, and the reasons they give each other for what they're going to do. And then her decision to go despite his raging. And the last line is, are you going to come back? And she says, yes, if. And it's up to you to fill in. What's the if? If he lets me? If I still love you? If I have something to tell you? Who knows? Now, it's important that in this act, in order to make it a really good story, we establish Guido's violent feeling for Mona Vanna. If he is kind of laid back, he says, sure, go right ahead. There's no play, there's no crisis. And yet, on the other hand, if he loves her with an immortal passion like Prince Ivali's, then there's no basis for her to make any decision. And it becomes deuce as well. She just has to toss a coin. So there's a very delicate balance in the writing here. Guido has to be violent but not impassioned in love. He has to be strong enough so we feel the conflict. And yet, when we get to Prince Valley, we said that wasn't love even though we thought it was. And similarly, she has to think it's love and make the same discovery we do when she gets to Act Two, it wasn't really. So that's very, very tricky writing. And you're absolutely at the mercy of the actress, or excuse me, of the actor, Guido. He can kill this part with the identical perfection to the text, fidelity to the text, if he's too sincere or too much of a cold fish. He's got to be just exactly right for this to work. Anyway, that's Act One, the establishment of the conflict with her departure. Act Two is the rise to the climax. She discovers who the mysterious enemy is. She falls in love with him, or rather re-falls in love with him, remembers who he was. And that is the climax, when she actually falls in love with him again, because we now know, given her character, given her commitment to him, where it's got to go. But he leaves her untouched precisely because he loves her so passionately. That's a point we'll have to come back to. That's very utterly essential to the play. That he doesn't touch her because he's so passionately in love with her. And that does not mean he's Catholic. And now she decides to return with him. The reason given in the play is she's going to save his life, and also she wants to explain it to Guido. So that's basically the rise is the whole part where they're exploring each other, who are you, and oh yes, I remember, and why didn't you, and why did you, and finally to come to see who he is and who she is and fall in love. And then Act Three, the resolution. She confronts Guido, who refuses to listen to the truth, and finally threatens Prince Ivali's life. And so she saves Prince Ivali by telling Guido the lie he wants to hear. And then the ending, now it's implicit, but I think it's so clear that I was astonished to hear that some people in this class regard it as controversial. I think it is self-evident. How's that for a dogmatic end to controversy? That they are going to live a blissful life together. They're going to run off together, and it's goodbye, Guido. And I mean, you can't get more clear than her last speech. I want the key alone, no one else. My life was indeed an evil dream, but a fairer one begins. Ah, a fairer one begins. Curtain, I mean, you can just see her. She's got the key and she runs to the prison, and it's very clear what she's going to do in the prison, let alone after they get out of it. You're never going to see them again. They take off. So it's definitely, unequivocally a happy ending. So in essence, the structure is very logical. Act one, she goes to Prince Ivali. Act two, she falls in love with him. Act three, she comes and saves his life and runs off with him. And each sequence is unavoidable. If she didn't go to him, there would be no play. When she gets to him, it is essential that she sees him, that she falls in love with him, but not that they don't make love. Why is that necessary? Why is that so crucial to the play? There are many reasons. Somebody. Well, I know, but you're attacking it from the playwright's point of view, but from her point of view. Yes.
It wasn't totally positive. How was it?
Well, she didn't know him that well, for one thing. But what we want to find out and what we have to see is the depth, the metaphysical quality of her love. And this would simply not be objective if she's summoned coercively and she falls into bed with him right away. That smacks of too much of a coerced role in the hay. Even if she said, oh, hi, yeah, it's you, it would still be coerced in inception, and it would be too fast for her to fall that deeply in love with him. Convincingly, you need some stage time and action. Most important, the audience need to see Guido come down in our estimation. Otherwise, we can never judge her character objectively. I mean, if she falls in love that fast, we don't know her. We're not given a curriculum vitae. We don't know a resume of her past affairs. For all we know, she's a slut who falls in love with anybody. So in order for us to be able to judge her, we need the same passage of time that she needs in order for her to judge him. We need time to go, and then we need to see him in relation to Guido, which is exactly what she needs to see. So it's perfectly synchronized on Maeterlinck's part. What the drama needs for objectivity is exactly what she needs in order to be able to behave irrationally. If they made love prematurely, it would sink her character, sink the audience's interest in the thing. It would turn the whole thing into a materialistic melodrama of the lowest order. So it's not that they don't want passionately to make love. The whole thing is that they do, and it's not that they have anything philosophic against making love, but it's a great situation where your hands are trembling to touch the body of the beloved, and there's a powerful reason why you can't do it now. Now, the same situation was in Atlas Shrugged, when Dagny and Galt, where she knew all she had to do is just get up and walk down the hall, and that was it, and she just tossed and tossed and tossed, and everyone in the readership wants her to do it, but she can't do it, and that drives an audience mad, and that is the same situation. Here is a fabulous situation. It just can't be overdone. And it's even better. You see that they both think sex is good. If they had this hesitation because one thought sex was evil, it wouldn't be as powerful. It's precisely the fact that they both think it's wonderful, but they can't do it that drives you crazy. So in any event, they do the right thing. They fall in love, but they don't touch each other. And that is precisely what Guido cannot believe. And that's when the audience starts to root for it to really happen. Now, why can't he believe it? He can't believe a love of that dimension, of that power. He doesn't hold a view of human nature that exalted or that passionate. He believes that people are essentially average guys. Women, if they don't sleep around, they cheat. Men are, you know, pretty much apes with a great sense of bravado, of a strong macho self-images. He has, in other words, a kind of conventional low view of life. And it's a metaphysical issue to him. It goes to the nature of man. He can't, Guido, he can't stand the idea that they spent the night together with her naked under her cloak, that they really loved each other and they didn't touch each other, because that represents a way of life that he feels is impossible. Maybe that's how he tolerates his own inadequate marriage, by saying, you know, there isn't such a great passion in the world. Maybe he's using it to rationalize. But the trouble is that as he sees it, if their story were true, it makes them saints, saints of passion, in a way that he feels he just can't equal. So he, to him, it is a self-esteem issue or a metaphysical issue. And Maeterlinck is so brilliant at presenting this that he has Guido willingly give them up. He tells them, look, go in love and I'll leave you alone if only you tell me the truth. It's more important to him to have his view of human nature confirmed and his life retroactively justified, even if he loses her, than to discover that there is an exalted quality to life that's possible that he has been betrayed. So he needs her to confirm his metaphysics, his view of life and of himself. And she refuses to lie until he forces the issue by threatening Prince Ivaly. And then, of course, she has to go along. She poses as Prince Ivaly's enemy for the sin of his lust against her. And that immediately kills Guido in her eyes and in the audience's eyes. He's out now as a consideration. You would be horrified at this point if she decided to go back to him. That would be a drama of Christian renunciation worthy, you know, of the sacrifice of Isaac to God. It would be the end of all self-assertion. Now, the brilliant gimmick is not the right word, or idea, or twist on Maeterlinck's part, is that Guido won't believe the truth. He demands the truth. He's doing everything to get the truth, but he's too weak for it, and he will only accept a lie as the truth. And thereby, he loses the battle for his own soul and lets his hated rival win out. He demeans himself to the status of the ordinary. Now, I'm afraid in the throes of excitement, I've given you some characterization out of order, but let us go to characterization in a more organized way, number four. Now, to grasp the theme and meaning of this play, you must understand the motivation of the characters in their key decisions. What kind of factors they're weighing and what kind of factors decide them. And there are really only four crucial decisions that make the entire progression of the play. So here are the four, and then to understand the motivations, we have to know the answers, and we'll take them up one at a time. But first, I'll tell you the four. Why does Mona Vanna decide to accept Prince Ivali's offer? Why doesn't she just say, no, I'm going to die here beside my husband? Of course, there'd be no play. But why does she decide to accept it? Remember, you have to give an answer from the point of view of the character, not of the author. And second, why did Prince Ivali make the offer to begin with? What did he really want from Mona Vanna, given the fact that he actually never did sleep with her? Why did he want her naked under her cloak? Number three, why does Mona Vanna return to Guido at all in the end, in Act Three? What does she expect from him when she returns? Does she want his blessing? Does she want to defy him? What? And four, the very easiest, once you know the answer to the first three, why does she finally choose Prince Ivali over Guido? Now, let me just ask you quickly by a show of hands. I'm going to just state the points here and ask you to raise your hands if you agree with what happened in the play. Not necessarily the reasons, which we haven't discussed, but just the facts. How many think Mona Vanna did the right thing in accepting Prince Ivali's offer and going to see him? Okay. How many think Prince Ivali did the right thing to make the offer in the first place? Seems to be a few fewer hands here. That means you got a big conflict if you think he shouldn't have made it, but she should have taken it. How many think that Mona Vanna did the right thing to return to Guido at all in the end? Yeah, I got the biggest show for that. See, so you still have a certain... Well, whatever. And then how many think she did the right thing in choosing Prince Ivali over Guido? Oh, there I got 100%. So you all agree with the end point, you just don't necessarily agree with how she got there. Now, I agree with all four. And if you didn't agree with one, actually, it would sink the play. And it's up to Maeterlinck to convince us of all four as the play goes on. Now, let's take them one at a time. Why does Vanna accept Prince Ivali's offer? Now, the standard answer, which scandalized Queen Alexandra, is that she was willing to sacrifice virtue for the well-being of her city. So she is, in effect, a true follower of John Stuart Mill and the hedonic calculus. She's a real utilitarian. That's the standard answer. And there's even some evidence that Maeterlinck thinks that. But we don't have to agree with him. Look at it this way. If a woman says, in the name of all my compatriots, who do matter something to me, I'll let them have my body for a night. Is that necessarily a sacrifice for her city? Now, of course, if the government orders her to do it, that is obviously a sacrifice of the individual. But here the conqueror asks for a night of lovemaking. Is that so obviously a sacrifice? Could she reason this way? Thousands of innocents will be spared, and he's going to get me anyway eventually when he conquers the city. And it's no moral stain on me since it was done under physical coercion. So the worst is an unenjoyable pawing, as against thousands of lives, including my own. Well, if you look at it that way, it's a calculation of positives and negatives, so it's not a sacrifice. Now, you can't really talk it away. In other words, to the extent that she has to give her body for a night to an unknown man for the sake of saving her city, you'd have to say yes. There's a core there that involves a sacrifice. She's giving a value by force that she would not give by persuasion or left to her own choice. She's having a value forced out of her, and to that extent she is being made to sacrifice. And Guido, correspondingly, is a sympathetic character in Act One to the extent that he is fighting for individual rights against the idea of sacrifice. It's a perfect setup to trap an objectivist audience, because he makes these speeches for individual rights and denounces the idea of sacrifice to the collective. Now, it's true that he seems to focus mainly on his right to his property, which is his wife, rather than her right to her life and pursuit of happiness. But this is, after all, in the Renaissance, prior to women's lib. All in all, however, I don't think Mona Vanna's decision is a sacrifice. Not to her, and really not to Maeterlinck. I don't think it's insignificant that the man wants to sleep with her, which is implicitly a compliment. Just imagine if it were you and you're home one day, I'm speaking to the ladies, and you get a call from an unknown admirer who is prepared to save the entire neighborhood from the plague if you'll come over for the night. And you start to inquire and you find he's heroic, he's literate, he's strong, he's romantic. I mean, at a certain point, this is a real fun sacrifice. The other important thing, which we learn later, but she implicitly, subconsciously knows it now, is she's not really in love with her husband. Not in the deepest, most passionate way. She's got an unfulfilled yearning for a dynamite love. The kind that would come in just this sort of way, as against the security of a boring, conventional love. So the thing is, her motives are pretty mixed in Act One. And the reason is she does not really know herself yet. She doesn't know what she craves. She doesn't know that she's frustrated in love. She doesn't know fully that she's settled for the second best in her marriage. So, in a sense, on the surface, she's doing her, quote, duty for the country. But it's her duty insofar as she is unawakened to her true nature. It's her duty as though she's still, so to speak, in a dream world or in a rut. It's a really, though, a very different situation from what would be an unequivocal sacrifice. Namely, she were passionate for Guido, disgusted by Prince Ivale. Now, that would be a sacrifice. But the reverse is hinted at very strongly. She's not so hot for Guido, and this guy sounds really intriguing, you see. Now, Act Three, I think, is the further proof that she is not a self-sacrificing type, because she has a real chance to sacrifice, to give up her true love for the sake of her husband, who is kind and conventionally decent. She has a chance to sacrifice and live the rest of her life with Guido, and how many seconds does she consider that option? Zero. She is not a sacrificial type. In fact, she sacrifices precisely only when she's not clear on the values involved, and therefore has no passionate course of her own to pursue, or when it's a mixed situation. And that's the way it stands in the beginning. So just to look at her development as a character. In Act One, she goes through a true, what they call, character arc. That is, she grows before your eyes, reaches a certain height, and then acts on it. She starts in Act One being unclear about her true values. Even though, from the very beginning, She's adventurous, strong, and relentless once she's made a decision. Her decision is a mixed bag. It's partly to save her city and partly because she wants something more out of life in an inchoate way. Then she proceeds to discover her true values, not only Prince Ivali, but the kind of love that he represents. And then you see the very same strong relentlessness that she had in taking the decision in Act One. Now she's going to secure and enjoy the value that that opened up to her. So she discovers the necessity. It's a beautiful paradox of the kind that Maeterlinck would love to discover, to create. She discovers the necessity of total selfishness by a seemingly selfless act. The selfless act, giving her body for her country, if you call it selfless, opens her to find her true values and turns her into an apostle of total selfishness. And that's the kind of paradox playwrights love to find. All right, that's why she accepted his offer. Now the second of the four questions. Why did Prince Ivali make it? What did he expect of the encounter? Did he want to sleep with her? Was he moved by a lust of the body? Well, in part. But their actions make clear that his is first is spiritual love. It's spiritual and physical love, but first he wants to see if she remembers, if she reciprocates. Is she happily in love with Guido? Is there still a chance for him? He doesn't want her body out of context. He wants her to love him and then to sleep with him. He also, remember, he was 12 the last time he talked to her. He wants to find out if she is as great as he remembers. So at the outset, he has no definite plans. It's a fishing expedition. It's an enraptured hope and a chance to see what's going on. And he's going to play it by ear according to what he sees. Now, one commentator in one of these Belgian books has the effrontery to say that Prince Ivali's motive is that he's testing her purity and that his secret hope is that she will reject his offer and go back to Guido, proving that she's still the virtuous girl he remembers, and that he can then go off and pine for her till death, and she can stay with Guido and suffer till death, and everyone will embody Christian virtue. I mean, my comment, which I wrote on the margin to that, is BS. So, it's a very helpful comment because there's nothing calmer that you can say. But that is actually how this is interpreted by many people in 1905 and 10 who were trying to defend Maeterlinck against the incredible charge that he was for selfishness and sex and all these bad things. All right, now the third question. What is Mona Vanna's intention in coming back with Prince Ivali to Guido in Act to Guido. I knew I would mispronounce that. To Guido in Act 3. Why don't they just run away? Is it only to rescue Prince Ivali? No, I don't think so. That's a conveniently created and pretty transparent setup by Maeterlinck. And it's obvious that she would still go back even if she had a way to save Prince Ivali without taking him too. Why then does she really go back? Who has an idea for that? Yes. Well, you say she wants to test Guido's love. She wants to compare the two. That's true. But I think she's really made the decision in falling in love with Prince Ivali in Act Two. But I think there is something she wants in relation to Guido. Yes, Phil.
I'm not sure it was in the play, but my hypothesis was her whole world sort of been turned upside down, and she needs mind-body integration. She needs to sort of see
see him and see the other person.
Well, you're saying the same thing. She needs to see the two together. That's part of it. But even suppose that she was completely decided in her own mind. Imagine you lived with somebody for how many years? And it was, on the face of it, a happy marriage. And you went away and fell passionately in love. Would you think it was right just to take off? Oh, I mean, what? Send him a postcard and say, Florence is great, glad you're not here? She owes him morally an explanation. She is not the kind of woman who could just vanish forever. They're not a hostile couple. She has found a greater love. She expects Guido to understand and accept it. She wants him to know the truth, and she fully believes that he'll believe her story, which is the truth, including her love for Prince Evalli. She wants him, in effect, to bless them in their new life. This was the hero she married, she thought, and this is what she expects. It's a matter of elementary justice and objectivity on her part. She's not going to treat him like dirt because she doesn't regard him as dirt. Now, in fact, if he had come through the way she expected, she would have been in a terrible conflict. Because he would then, in understanding this love, have proved that he is the type who is capable of a love of that dimension. He would have been as metaphysically profound in his approach to love as Prince Evalli, and by the very act of setting her free out of his very love for her, she would have had a horrible time choosing. And in fact, in my opinion, if he had done this, I think the best ending would have had to be some version of a ménage à trois. In other words, like, you know, alternate custody. One man gets her 1 week. Now, I'm quite serious in saying that in that situation, under these circumstances, I would vote for that as philosophically absolutely justified. But it would make a different play. That is not the way it is. And that would have required some remarkable character change on his part, because from the outset, he is presented as a conventional man, basically good, a good commander, even a man with a grasp of principle, but possessive in a bad sense. It's his wife, like a piece of property, and he's also presented, remember, as very social. What will other people think if you go away like this? And remember, in theater, every sentence counts. If a character, if the author lets him say, well, what will everybody think? He's already a social type. And given that type, it's a setup for him to react the way he does. If Maeterlinck wanted to make her life hell, he would have had to make Guido so good at the beginning that she's constantly torn, and it would end up, in effect, the indecision of Mona Vanna. She just never knows which man she wants, and then he'd have to have a different theme and a different character, a whole different play, and it just wouldn't be this play. As it is, as we've said, he condemns himself to the status of non-valuer by the very fact that he won't accept her truthful story and thereby frees her to live with Prince Evalli. And the eloquent fact is that she has to lie for him to recognize and feel at home with what she's saying. He has to feel they're all on the same, quote, human level, which exalts them and frees her morally and emotionally from him. And so the answer to question 4, why does she leave Guido? Because now she's really in love with a worthy man. And why should she go with the man she loves? Well, that's the play. One must always act on what one really loves, not what people expect, no matter whether they're your husband, the city, society, whatever. And that, of course, takes us right into the theme, but first the break. I'm going to give you 7 minutes today. All right, now the theme. The theme of Mona Vana is the importance of what? What word would Maeterlinck use to say? The importance of love. Not just sexual love, but romantic love as the expression of soul and body. Love as response to fundamental values, to the kind of man in Mona Vana's case, the actions he takes, the life he lives. So the importance of love really means the importance of values in life, the importance of personal values and of action to achieve these. That's what counts in life. Values are achievable, so this play is thoroughly benevolent universe. These values depend on man's choice. How do we know that Maeterlinck believes in free will and man's choice of values? It's exactly the way we know from Corneille, namely what? They agonize. Should I do this? Well, I've got these reasons. Should I do this? No, I got these reasons. Back and forth. You see the process of thought, of debate, of discussion, of trying to figure out what to do. And then their decision. So his theme in that sense is the importance of man's or woman's strength in the sense of their commitment to their values and to life. And when he summarized it to, or Marco actually puts it in this sentence, life is right. And I think the meaning of that, which is a fairly undefined statement, but I think the meaning is the pursuit of values is right, as against duty or obligation to husband, family, society, etc. So using the idea of life here, we could say that the theme is, it's all different ways of saying the same basic thing, life demands and goes to the passionate valuer. Now Guido fails the test. He doesn't know what valuing is. Prince Valley and Mona Vana know. They refuse to sacrifice their values. Notice, Prince Valley tried to sacrifice for her. You know, the idea she'll have a happier life without him with her wealthy husband and so on, and thereby almost lost her. And the really interesting thing in this, in connection with this aspect of the theme, is Mona Vana's anger, her indignation at Prince Valley for having dreamt of sacrificing, for not having seized, gone after and taken what he wanted in life, but hung back all those years, watching and waiting and thinking, well, he's not enough and she's got such a good life, etc. Now this is a truly brilliant twist on Maeterlinck's part, because in a play like this, by all precedent from the traditional plays, in Act One, the villain makes a demand. I want your body. I want to sleep with you. In Act Two, she's supposed to come back and say, in essence, how dare you? And the absolutely brilliant thing is, she comes back in Act Two and says, what kept you? And that is really brilliant. I mean, that just is like, he transcends his entire generation with it. She denounces him for being a coward, for not knowing what love is,
And here is this guy who expects that he's going to be denounced for asserting himself, suddenly finds he's on the defensive for being too humble and self-sacrificial. And it's a wonderful twist. And it brings out the Maeterlinck's idea that Mona Vana is so selfish that she simply expected selfishness on the part of someone she loved, and she was just indignant. She equated love with selfishness. In other words, you want something, you want to have it. And he had to really work to dig himself out of that hole, Prince Ivali. So that makes the theme clearer than any other thing. It's the primacy of personal love over duty of any kind. The primacy and achievability of selfish values, if we put it more abstractly. It's also been worded in some of the books I read, the power of love to triumph over obstacles and to illuminate the essence of life. And one commentator puts it, love can elude destiny. Now, when Maeterlinck was younger, he thought that love was doomed in his depressed phase and that destiny would crush us all. But now he has broken through to the idea that if you love passionately, you can break any deterministic bounds. Now, this ode to love, I have to say, is in tremendous contrast to what playwright who thinks that love sinks you like a stone if you love too well? Shakespeare. It's even in contrast to Sophocles, who has an ode or two on you better be careful around love because it smashes everything and it's wanton and who knows where it's going to lead. And here we now have love as the liberating factor. So it's a very distinctive, historically a distinctive theme. And so the message of this whole play is really the need to discover your personal values, which is what Mona Vana had to do, and then act on them against everybody if it's necessary. Now, this is a play purely on the moral level. Maeterlinck himself has nothing much to say about social ethics. I don't know if you're surprised, or by now you're probably inured to the fact that all these playwrights, I'm choosing some of their best moments, but some of the other plays, you would faint to see the things they say, and Maeterlinck is capable in other works of abundant altruism, praise of sacrifice, even of socialism. But somehow, despite all of this, he has a conviction, at least in his optimistic phase of life, of the supremacy of personal values. And he let the logic of this conviction lead him to write a play such as Mona Vana. And you just have to say that the theme of this play is really the same as the theme of The Fountainhead. In essence, he doesn't distinguish the second-hander versus the first-hander. He doesn't give the epistemological or the consciousness that accompanies it. But the idea of connecting selfishness with nobility, with the highest aspiration of man, with the soul of the morally elite, as against the petty desires of the masses or the ordinary people who care for very little and who are busy making sacrifices and expecting to receive them, that is absolutely The Fountainhead. And so it should be no surprise to you that Ayn Rand loved this play, and I hope no surprise to you that he loved The Fountainhead. So there was a mutual admiration society for a while, as long as he lived, between the two of them, despite the fact that there was a tremendous gulf between them on many philosophic issues. I don't know that she met him, Ayn Rand met him personally, but she did correspond with his wife, and he did, through his wife and through editors, retail to her stories about his discovery of The Fountainhead on display in the palaces of European nobility, which she frequented. And needless to say, she got a lot of pleasure out of that. All right, let's go to number six, his wider philosophy. You know, of course, probably that she tried to get a movie made of this for years. Just could not get the studios to come near. The closest they ever came is Indecent Proposal. Maeterlinck does not have a deeper philosophy. All you can ascribe to him with any meaning is the essence of Romanticism: free will, choice of values, the need of strength, the importance of selfishness, the possibility of the good. All of that he's very aware of. He's very aware of the issue of free will because he was a determinist earlier in life. And remember, Monavana says it's never too late. There's still time. We still can do it, no matter how many years we've lost. It's the idea. It's within our choice. So it's definitely man as a being of self-made soul. But there is no more to be found philosophically in this play. And in that respect, it is beneath all the other plays in this course. It has no metaphysics or epistemology of any kind expressed in the play. And every other one, in some form or another, has. Now, if you want to scrounge for implication, you could say it's not too religious a play, because the theme is the importance of life on earth, of your own life, and specifically of sexual love as a tremendous value. So it would be a big surprise to find that he was a religious type, which he isn't. But on the other hand, he was a real mystic, a kind of freewheeling, wild mystic. At the same time, he is so strong a valuer that you would be very surprised to find that he was a cynic, for instance, or a skeptic who says, who could know anything? So you could try to argue, well, by implication, he's not religious, he's not a skeptic, he's really an Aristotelian, pro-earthly, pro-reason. But if he was, he sure didn't know it. And I don't think it's accurate or profitable to ascribe metaphysics or epistemology to authors who have no explicit ideas in their play about these subjects. Or in other plays, when they do discuss philosophy, have diametrically opposite ideas. So I think, for instance, Schiller is full of explicit ideas. Shaw is full. Corneille has got metaphysics and epistemology all over, right on the next to the surface of the play. The idea of a feudal intrinsicist code gives you his whole fundamental philosophic approach. This is the only unphilosophical play in the course. Unphilosophical in the sense that it has a moral theme, a theme pertaining to morality, but that's it. It has a great sense of life, but it's the reason why I debated whether to include it, because I call this Seven Great Plays. And I'm going to explain to you on Saturday why I regard having philosophy in some form as essential to greatness in a play. That is going to be the most controversial thing I say, but since I say it, I have a little doubt about this play as being included. On the other hand, it has such a terrific sense of life, and it has so many wonderful things in a play. And I just thought that for this one case, happiness outweighs philosophy. Now, if you want to see where Maeterlinck actually stands on philosophic issues, I'll give you just a brief glimpse of his philosophic development so you can see where Monavana comes in his works. As I said, he was brought up in Catholic schools, but it never really took. he had a precarious faith for a while, but it withered, and he was eventually put, believe it or not, on the index. And he was kind of a freewheeling mystic. He was open to anything, science, extrasensory perception, you name it, whatever came by. In his early years, he was influenced by guess which three figures. He was utterly malevolent, and so what German voluntarist was perfect for him? Schopenhauer. He felt that there's no use having any emotions because you're doomed to defeat, so he took as the champion of repression what Greek Stoic, Roman Stoic? Marcus Aurelius. And of course, he lived in the 19th century, so you have to throw Darwin in. Those were the three figures that most influenced him, and you can figure from that. He was also depressed. He believed that life is hell. Part of it was that his parents forced him to become a lawyer. In any event, he held explicitly that man is helpless. In fact, in his early plays, the actors have strings attached to them, which are supposed to show that they're marionettes and dancing on strings and have no will of their own. That's the same man who wrote Mona Vanna. He had death with a capital D as one of the figures and one of the characters in the play, and death would always wipe out all the others. He was a real pessimist. Then comes the revolution, Georgette LeBlanc. He fell in love, and it had a tremendous effect on him. The quote from Prince Ivaly, which I'll read now, which he says to Mona Vanna, is supposed to be pure autobiography on the part of Maeterlinck's part of Maeterlinck. Quote, "It seemed also to me that," when he fell in love, "it seemed also to me that men were changing, that I had been mistaken about them until this day. It seemed to me above all that I was changing myself, that I was emerging at last from a long prison, that the doors were opening, that flowers and foliage were pushing aside the bars, that the horizon was removing each stone, that the pure morning air was penetrating my soul and engulfing my love." So there is a huge changeover philosophically to the benevolent universe, the power of man, love as able to overcome all obstacles, etc. Now, did he have any definitive or distinctive ideas philosophically during his optimistic period? He was a dabbler. He just pontificated. He came up with observations out of the blue. And here's a typical Boris Maeterlinck idea of this phase. He was writing on bees, B-E-E-S. And it came to him that maybe it would be profitable to compare man to the bees. And I quote from, this is in a non-fiction essay of his. "Man's goal, the aim of life like that of the insect, may be no more than its own initial impetus. Yet just as the destiny of the honeybee is to produce honey, man's may be that of creating the strange fluid known as thought. We know not where this activity will lead, but the bee is ignorant of why it secretes nectar, nor who will profit from this spiritual substance in the world. But the process must continue. The final principle, God, providence, nature, chance, fatality, what's in a name? The final principle may be good or evil, but the life process must be lived." Unquote. So that is the message of the more optimistic Maeterlinck. In effect, it comes down to live, think, love. Who knows what it all means or what's behind it all? So That's why I say he is less philosophical by far than any of our other authors. He is just not a philosophic thinker, period. And it's hardly surprising, therefore, that after his affair with Mademoiselle LeBlanc was over, he fell again into darkness and pessimism. And the tragedy is that he had such a soaring moment in his life, and then in his old age he ends with this confession, quote, "I shall leave this life having sought to know all and having learnt nothing," unquote. It shows the power of philosophy. It shows that a sense of life, even so brilliantly articulate a one that could lead to a play like this, is just not sufficient equipment if you needed any more propaganda. He ended up anti-communist, anti-Christian, vaguely mystical, pro-individualistic, and all in all defeated. So if you rush out to get his other plays, are you going to be surprised? Now, I want to close with one stylistic observation of Maeterlinck. He has a fine sense specifically of drama, which is something that you can't find anymore. And I'll give you as an example the deliberate twist of the ending. Think how much more dramatic it is that Mona Vanna wins by a lie rather than by the truth. Now, we've discussed the meaning, but just from the point of view of drama, it's a paradox, it's a twist, it's like an O. Henry type of ending. As against, if she had come in and said, "I love him," and he said, "Okay." But the idea here is the lie wins because he's after the truth and he can't take it. So the lie is like an incredibly dramatic slap in the face. It's not just communication of information. She's telling him implicitly, you are too pitiful to face reality. You are a nothing. It is a kind of decisive, judgmental, and passionate in a way that no mere communication of ideas could be. And going along with that, the fabulous double meanings in the last pages of this play. Now, we've discussed this. What play did we... Which was it? Othello. Othello, right. Well, this play has a wonderful... If you turn to page 99, there's a wonderful speeches by Mona Vanna to Guido, allegedly about Prince Ivali, but actually about Guido to his face. And it's wonderful drama, precisely because we know her meaning, and Guido doesn't, and she has the brass, the courage to tell him in this way, starting near the bottom of 99, when she's already in the lying mode. Ah, what fools men are! It is just to deceive them, since they worship falsehood. You see, she's saying this bitterly to him, about him, but allegedly about Prince Ivali. It's a fabulous double meaning. When one shows them life, they take it for death. When one offers them death, they grasp at it for life. He thought to master me, and I have mastered him. And she's saying this to her. The man to his face. Behold him already in his tomb, and I shall put the seals upon it. I mean, she is telling him to his face, in 3 seconds I'm going to be in bed with this guy. I brought him hither, decking him with kisses as a lamb with garlands, and he is in my hands that shall never loose their hold. And then she has the I mean, it's just chilling. She turns to him and she says, "Ah, my fair lover, Prince Ivali, we shall have kisses such as none have ever known." Because Guido thinks she's being really sarcastic. And she goes so far as to go up to Prince Ivan and give him a quote, ardent kiss, and says, Gianello, I love you. Kiss me again. These are the kisses that avail. And of course, Guido is supposed to think she's just torturing him. She's showing him, you know, this is what you're never going to have. And of course, she's showing him, this is what you're going to have right away. Now, you cannot beat that for drama that properly acted is completely enthralling on the stage. It just sends shudders through you as you watch the different characters. If it's well done, it's fabulous. It's a life-altering experience. Just that quality of drama in and of itself. So I want to conclude on the note that despite Maeterlinck's deeper ignorance of philosophy, he did have, when he was liberated from depression, a joyous and highly dramatic sense of life. And with that and with his talent, he wrote a truly great play. I hope you liked it as much as Miss Rand, and then thanks to her, I did. Thank you very much. Now, I have a written question, but I also have a little anecdote that I thought you might be interested in hearing. This is from a 1951 book that I got in the Belgian consulate by Patrick Mahoney called The Magic of Maeterlinck. And he comments, this play is made to order for a film production and was actually done in Italy about 1913. Now, if anybody has any connections to Italian silent movies, I would be fascinated to know, you know, because they did a great movie of We the Living, and this is a very similar plot situation, and 1913 would be just about right. That's still before World War I, barely. But if anybody can find that, it might be a real treasure, but I don't even know if those things physically survive anymore. Anyway, he goes on to say, Monavana was the subject of conversations between myself and a major Hollywood studio during Maeterlinck's exile in America. The speeches are a little long for presentation to the current American taste. He's saying this in 51, so you can imagine in 93. But I think the technical skill which Maeterlinck shows in unfolding the plot is self-evident. There are the three distinct elements which must be, I believe, the ingredients of a successful film treatment. Monavana's sacrifice, that is Act One, the awakening of her soul, and the triumph of her love over destiny. That's how he put it. The film deal fell through because the studio wanted to turn the story into a musical comedy. For one of their more famous lightweight actresses to play the lead. Maeterlinck refused, and wisely, I think. In this connection, I couldn't resist telling him the story about the Irish playwright who was asked to submit something for a certain Hollywood studio. This is undoubtedly Shaw, because that would be the famous Irish playwright at the time. The script was found unavailable, and there was a polite note accompanying the rejection from the studio, which said that the studio hoped that he might make other submissions. The reason for the rejection was because the story of the play did not contain the essential ingredients of a successful film. And for his information, the studio recounted these elements, the necessary ingredients. Quote, religious sentiment, dramatic surprise, sex appeal, brevity, and human interest. The Irish writer wrote back a charming letter saying that he had pondered their formula and had come to the conclusion that the best film story could be written in one sentence. He asked, "How would this do?" "My God," cried the Duchess, "let go my leg." For that has the entire mixture. Now you want to know why in 1993 they don't want to make a movie of Atlas Shrugged that is true to the novel. All right, I'm going to take questions now. We've got fairly substantial time for questions, so I'm going to make this open to all the plays and not just to Monavana. Any residual question now, so you can't complain I didn't give you time. Yes?
We seem to have given Monavana a philosophical mercy grade by including it in a list of great plays, yet the reference to the Ayn Rand quote about it being one of the greatest plays leads me to wonder then what somewhat different standard she was applying there.
Well, I would include it as a great play. I would do that. But I do that with a certain hesitancy. It depends in what context you are thinking. There are a lot of plays that I would say, this is a great play, and I would write it in a letter to someone even, that I would not necessarily print in a catalog and come up before an audience. Because when you say, you know, this is a great play, or even you write in a letter, your context can be tremendous. You can be thinking of a brilliant plot theme. You can be thinking of character development, elevated dialogue, double meanings, twists, benevolence, sense of life. There's 100 different ways in which you can say, judged by these standards, this is one of the top plays in world literature, or world history. I had a very definite context in mind. And I was talking 7 great plays as philosophy and as literature. And that is not an empty title. I'm trying to say plays that qualify for greatness in both their literary and philosophic dimension, you see, which to me is a higher rank than just a play which qualifies on one scale. And it's because I was using that, and I'm making a formal address which is going to last beyond my lifetime, that I have to be able to justify. I can't just say, it's a great play, I'm going to toss it in a list of great plays. I have to know what exact criterion am I using. There's hundreds and thousands of plays that in one way or another you could legitimately say it's great. So I don't have any reason to believe that she had the same context. She was not preparing a course and making a formal selection from the ages, you see. Now, knowing her, she might very well disagree with certain points that I make on Saturday, because these do not come ex cathedra. You know, we'll never know. The only way we'll ever know is if you can refute me to my face on Saturday, and you'll have the chance to do it. Diane.
Thank you. I had a question. I was a little thrown off by a couple of things in Monavana, and it kind of led me at the end to be confused. She was weak when they left the tent of Prince Savali, and he had to help her get back to Guido. And then in her final speech, where all the double meanings were and where she was being very strong, she, if I remember, she leaned up against a pole like she was going to pass out. And I thought, I feared the worst. At the end, she was actually dying in her swoon because of this underlying thing I couldn't get out of my mind about her weakness. Do you know what his intention on that was?
Well, I don't know, but I can guess certain things. I think first and foremost, the weakness is the power of emotion. She's overcome by the intensity of the scene. But I think he wanted to invoke a certain additional suspense. You know, the turn of the century and before, women died very rapidly, especially on stage. You know, they got a chill, they coughed, and that was it. So I think he's basically cheating there a little bit. He's using a conventional formula about a woman who's very strong to eke out a little bit of fear on the part of the audience. But I don't think that's inherent in the characterization. And I think she's the opposite of the kind that would go weak with too much emotion. As far as the issue of her being wounded, you know, she gets cut just above the breast as she's entering the tent. That, to me, is really extraneous. He uses it in the third act to prove that she really underwent a threat at the hands of Prince Ivali. But it's completely gratuitous. There was no way of the wound logically leading to that. I really think that the reason he had her wounded was what you call a symbolic, not an actual reason. You know, he was a, quote, symbolist with a capital S. And a symbolist is somebody who sees symbols everywhere. And so, from his early training, he liked the idea. Here are these two lovers, separated, yearning, bleeding from the wounds of life, and they're both bleeding, in fact, from their bodies, you see. So I think part of the reason he gave a wound to each was you would have the picture of the... They're actually bleeding, not in a major way, but as a symbol of their souls are bleeding, you see. And then they staunch up their wounds and put their arms around each other and transcend the situation. I think if I were in his mind, that's the deeper reason, but I don't believe that it's a plot indication at all, and that her life was ever for a moment in jeopardy, and if he threw you off, that's a flaw on his part.
Thank you.
Yes.
Do you think there are any moral rules that apply to the question, should a man start a courtship of another man's life? And if so, did Prince Ivali violate any of those moral principles?
Well, the only moral rule that I can think of is that a one man should not abet a dishonesty on the part of the wife. Now, inviting her out for the night is certainly is suggestive of something, but it's done openly. He didn't call her on, well, there was no phone, but he didn't send her a secret message. He gave the ultimatum directly to Guido. In fact, he thought the decision was Guido, so it's completely out in the open. And it was tantamount to saying to Guido, you decide. If her fidelity is that important, you make the decision. You keep her. So I do not believe that Prince Ivali did anything covert or hidden. And in fact, he had the honor of not touching her for the reasons I've mentioned, even when he could have. The only point at which he did anything that, you know, could be considered starting a sexual relationship with her is when he was seized by guards, thrown into jail, taken prisoner. Now, at that point, he's under force. Guido is the enemy. He owes him nothing. So I do not think there was a moment of immorality. It's a much broader question. If you know that a wife is unhappy, it is not your obligation to call her husband and say, I think I'm going to move in. It's her obligation. On the other hand, you could be legitimately uncomfortable, but you basically have to take the attitude, it's hers to live with, it is not mine, as long as you can see a reason why she's remaining faithful, even if you think it's wrong. Now, why did Dagny have an affair with Reardon knowing he's married? She was not immoral. On the contrary, she said, if that's what you want, and He didn't conceal from her that he was married. She knew that he was married to someone that was not worthy of him, but he didn't fully know it yet. And she was prepared to live with that, and I think that is completely moral on her part. It was even moral on his part because he was absolutely torn. He owed his loyalty to Lillian, he thought, and on the other hand, everything in him rebelled against that because he was a hero. But he thought it would be dishonor, you know, to breach his marriage vows. He couldn't live with them or without them, so he had a terrible conflict. He was utterly mistaken, but it was certainly not a reflection on his morality or on Dagny's. And in this case, it was a reflection on Lillian, that she was such a witch and could conceal it. So I don't have a moment's hesitancy in giving Prince Ivali A+ for morality. Yes.
Can you comment on the character's context in judging them? I was discussing this play with someone and telling him how much I admired Prince Ivali, and he was horror-struck because he said, well, he initiated force. Or
how did he initiate force? You mean the war?
Yeah. And I think that's what he was saying, or that...
Well, and we are not told anything in this play by which to be able to judge whether you should be on the side of Pisa or Florence.
Yeah, but...
We're just told they're at war. That's all that's required. Now, the Florentines say that the Pisans slaughtered somebody, and the Pisans say the Florentines constantly go around and kill them. This is not a play of international diplomacy. So it's exactly the same thing, and it's important that you know where you begin judging a play and where you don't. You can't trace the backstory back forever. So what you do is you plunge in with what's given, and then you judge the moral issues within that framework. It's exactly analogous to Sophocles. We are not given the basis to decide which of the two brothers, Eteocles or Polynices, is the best, or whether one is better than the other. All we know is they were on opposite sides, and that set up the situation. And the same thing is true. It wouldn't make any difference to this play if they both honestly believed in self-defense, or one country was wicked and the other wasn't. That is not the story. The story is they're basically Renaissance city-states that go to war on a regular basis. It's like Republicans and Democrats. And they're gentlemen and scholars. Plus, they fight each other, and they always have grievances. And the Florentine council is corrupt, but undoubtedly the Pisan elders are corrupt. All of that is completely beside the point. To judge Prince Ivali on that basis is just to make a mockery of moral judgment, and it's to create an entirely different play out of whole cloth, out of a sheer dogmatism, because you're saying, whoever uses force is wrong. That's absurd. Guido has been using force all the way through, and there's no use telling me which city attacked which first, because there's no issue of that in the play. Artist creates his own universe, and within certain limits you have to accept his universe. In other words, if he tells you who started this war is irrelevant. Now, he can't go beyond certain limits. There are certain historical facts which are so indelible and so monstrous that if an author said, I'm ignoring those facts, and yet it's a historical situation, you'd have to say, I'm not going to go with them. For instance, suppose somebody has a story in a concentration camp, and they say, I'm discounting the guards. You know, let's forget the fact that there were Nazis in charge here. Now what should you do? Say, oh, this, I can't read this because this is depraved. You are omitting a massive major fact of history which can't be put aside. But we are centuries away from what were, after all, decorous, gentlemanly city-states compared to anything we've ever seen. I mean, they're playing cricket here, you know. And the idea of judging Prince Ivali as an exponent of force is just ludicrous. Ludicrous. It's tragic to spend time discussing. Yes, next.
Of all the plays we've read, Monavana seems peculiar in that the protagonist was not in the main conflict. The main conflict being between Guido and...
Well, yes, she is.
Not...
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, no, the main conflict revolves in relation to her. But she is deeply involved in making the decisions. So if you want to reword it to include the protagonist, you'd have to say the main conflict is Mona Vanna versus Guido and Mona Vanna versus Prince Ivali, because she's fighting both men. She fights Guido to get to Prince Ivali, and then she fights herself and fights him, and in fact she's mad at him and she doesn't know what to think of him. But the reason I put it as Guido versus Prince Ivali is that is the naked, unequivocal conflict that goes from beginning to end. Mona Vanna switches, and a defining, essential conflict has to run throughout and unite a play. The antagonism of the two men is from open to close over her, you see. So it's not so paradoxical, because it's a conflict over the protagonist that the protagonist has to decide, but they are still the ones at war over it and trying to influence her decision. Yes.
I have a brief comment and a question, if I may.
Okay. Oh, you, that's right. You told me something. Everybody always tells me interesting things at intermission. I always urge them, why don't you tell them to the audience? So this gentleman's going to do it.
This is a true story. I personally know of a woman who was in love with a man. She was married and she was in love with another man. And he had, in fact, turned out to be the best friend of her husband, to make it more complicated. And she came to her husband and told him about the fact that she was in love with this other man, and she wanted his blessing, in essence. It's very similar to the play. He, in fact, loved her so much that he actually did give her his blessing and said, I want you to be happy, please, if this is your choice. And as a consequence of that action on his part, she was so torn that she couldn't leave him and stayed with her husband.
So what did she do?
I'm sorry?
What did she end up doing?
She stayed with her husband.
Oh, she rejected the lover, though?
Yes.
And was she able to feel happily fulfilled by that choice in the course of time? I mean, after she got over the...
Well, in the course of time, the romantic relationship did disintegrate. I didn't tell that part, but unfortunately...
That's why art is way ahead of life, yeah? You mean to go through all of that and then... So did she go back to the original lover?
No, she never did that.
Why? He was already involved?
They were... You know, life does have its
inconsistencies. No, sir, I don't know.
I didn't want to go into all
the
details.
You are in love, you should be in love for 50 years without wavering. And the idea that, unless you change your mind, but the idea that she gave him up and then she found that he was really the one, but, you know, she had to watch TV instead. Anyway, that is instructive, because it's too bad you didn't tell me the unhappy ending part of it, but it would be a situation similar to this, but where she would be in terrible agony over the very fact that the husband did come up with a magnanimous answer.
So now, that part was true. Can I ask the question?
Sure.
Okay. It's hard for me to write. I tried to write this down. I hope it's not misunderstood. I'm thinking about Ayn Rand's life and the fact that she had such very passionate values when she was very young, and that she gradually formed an explicit philosophy of objectivism. And I'm wondering whether you can answer this question. Is the main function of an objective philosophy to lead us to find values worthy of living for, or is it to teach us how to objectify, integrate, and defend and achieve rational values which we already have discovered and possess?
Well, I don't know. What is the main function of nutrition? To discover food or to eat it? What's more important? Well, it's a false alternative. You have to find out that you need food. You have to find out what kind of food is good for you. You have to find out how to grow or cultivate or provide it, and then you have to eat it. and find out how much to eat at a given setting and etc. What to do if you don't digest it. There's an entire complicated process which nutrition has to study. You can't take one element of it and against another element and say, which are we really trying to do? Now, what philosophy does with values is everything. It tells you what kind of universe are you valuing in, which will govern what kind of values are even possible to you. And how do you know that those values are any good? How do you know anything, which is your epistemological basis? And what kind of a being is man? And what does he need values for? And then what are values, and what are the right values, and what are the options within those values, and how can you achieve those values? What kind of action should you take? And how do you know when you're right, and how do you know when you're wrong, and will you win, will you gain success or not, and what are the implications of your values for art and politics? I mean, all of that is philosophy, and it's one continuous subject matter. And you no more can break it into either ors as the main function. The main function is to establish the correct relation between man and the universe. That's the main function of philosophy. Its main function doesn't even mention the term value. It's to connect man to reality proper. And that involves first connecting his consciousness to reality and then connecting his course of action to reality. And it's involving the course of action that you bring in the question of values. So there's a way in which everything you said is part of the main function of philosophy, and there's a way in which nothing you said is part of the main function of philosophy. And I don't know now if I've helped you or made it worse. Does that help? You want to ask a follow-up? I can hear you. Yeah. Well, you see, the thing is, in her life, there was no dichotomy between her values and her philosophy. In discovering her values, she was making the first steps of discovering her philosophy. If she found that she admired the hero of a child's story, that to her did not mean, well, this is an interesting story, now someday I'll think about philosophy and what it means. In the same woman, it was man the hero, free will, the struggle against evil, the need of action to achieve, all of that is what she was responding to and identifying. All of that was at the same time her value and the start of her philosophy. You put it as though she has an impossible alternative. Either she starts without values, comes up with a philosophy, and then says, well, now, by deduction, if I hold this philosophy, I got to hold value A, B, C. No one could do that because where would the philosophy come from? Nor, on the other hand, could you say, have just a bunch of mindless values, unintellectualized, and then say, now, one day I'm going to abstract what they all have in common, because it would be too gigantic a feat. You would end up then just an unconscious repository of whatever your subconscious conclusions were. The actual way that a philosophic mind develops, I mean, on the positive type of philosophy, is you have strong values which you identify contextually as you go. So there's no possible way of saying at any moment, the values preceded the philosophy, or the philosophy preceded the values, or the values are a means to the philosophy, or the philosophy is a means to the values. It is exactly simultaneous. It's like the mind and the action aspect of exactly the same process of mental growth and interaction with reality. So there seems to me something really rationalistic about your question. I have a written question here. Could you explain why you say that Mona Vanna made her decision to stay with Prince Ivali in Act 2? Well, I say, to be exact, she fell in love with Prince Ivali in Act 2. That is the climax. That is not exactly the same as she made her decision. I say it as a climax, it implied, it led to her final decision. And we have every reason to expect that from her falling in love, given her character and the situation, she's going to decide. But she doesn't actually make the decision to stay with him until Guido, falls in her eyes at the end. That's when she says, all right, to hell with you. So she comes back. Remember, she said she'd come back if. And she's come back partly to give him the explanation. Maybe that's what threw you off, that I said she came back to explain it to him. But it's also partly, and importantly, to re-see Guido through the eyes of what she's now learned about Prince Ivalli and see, is he the man that she thought? And in that sense, I don't think she makes her final decision airtight of what she's going to do until she basically announces it to Guido himself. Now you say, did Prince Ivalli know they were just going back to get Guido's acceptance? No, I believe that Prince Ivalli's motivation was supposed to be provided by Maeterlinck as he went back for his own safety. I don't think, in his mind, at least there's no indication of this, he went back with the idea. He wouldn't have a special interest in saying, goodbye, Guido, it's been nice, and I hope you understand. So I don't think that was part of his motivation. Harry.
You compared Mona Vanna to We the Living. I saw a tremendous similarity to Ideal. Would you comment if you
Well,
see
do you want to comment on that? Because you obviously have something in mind.
It's the metaphysical soul, the great person trying to find a soulmate.
Yeah.
It's two unusual spirits who are alone and find each other through a series of encounters. So I saw it. It had the spirit of Ideal.
Yeah, I think there's a very good point there, the parallel to Ideal. The only difference is that the heroine in Ideal is more formed from the very outset. She knows exactly what she wants, and she's embittered by the world, whereas Mona Vanna is presented as more confused and less self-knowledgeable at the beginning. She's not out looking. Life is okay. And then, from the outside, she's struck with the discovery that there's something much better, and she comes alive. So there is that difference, but I think it's very understandable, knowing Ayn Rand and the life she lived, and you're going to tell us about that. Are you started today? Or no, tomorrow you start. She was very alone in life. She was not that she wasn't married, but from growing up, she was like the heroine in Ideal. She was highly conscious that she could not find what she wanted from the world or from men, from boys at that age, and I think she would sympathize with the heroine of Ideal and with Mona Vanna and with Kira, and they're all plays that or stories that center around a woman. So that's kind of like early Ayn Rand, you see. And at a certain point, she turned over to being man-centered, and her concern was then she looked at the world like through the eyes of Rourke or Galt. But in her early days, I think this would have been a natural, and I think you're right to point out a similarity to Ideal. There was definitely a community between her and Maeterlinck, but the thing is, she took that as just a starting point, and then there was an entire philosophy, and he reached that as the culmination of his optimism and then sank back, so he never went anywhere with it. All right, well, take a couple more. Yes.
Thank you. I just want to make three short points and then a comment. The first one is, there's an aspect of the play that you didn't mention at all, and that is the aspect of the fact that the Florentines were planning his demise. In other words, he was under threat of death from the Florentines during this whole period.
I tried to imply, let me just take these as they go, to imply that by the fact that he needed to save his life to get away from them, but I didn't think that's important enough. That's the mechanics of the play.
Yeah.
Well, okay, what's your next? I don't try to cover every aspect of a play. If I covered every aspect of a play, you know what I would do? I would do it like this. I'd say, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Now, Act One scene begins in a hall in the palace of Guido Colonna. We see Guido and his lieutenants, Borso and Torello, near an open window from which a view is gained to the country about Pisa. Now, I happen to have a slide here of just... That is not the way I cover plays.
No.
And I venture to say that if that's the way you cover plays, you don't get the essential. Next.
I couldn't agree more. Okay. And the point I'm looking at here is motivation for his actions, not to cover the whole plot.
No,
I don't mind being the butt of humor. I mean, you know, let it rip.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you don't.
Good. Well, then, let's...
I don't think that his motivation at that point is key to what happens in the play. I do think Maeterlinck tried to provide him with the need for safety as a plausible motivation, but I don't think that's a strong point in the play, so having mentioned it, I let it go. It's not a thematic point to the play.
Okay. Point two was that he did offer Manavana an impossible choice. And the you made several points of that during the analysis, and the main one to me was the fact that were the city to be sacked, in all probability she would lose her life. In that sense, there really wasn't a lot of choice on any basis.
Well, there wasn't a lot of choice, and yet she still had the choice, if you want to put it that way, of staying and being raped or going and being raped.
Mm-hmm. Right. The third point
is... Which is a choice. Yeah.
Third point is, it comes out of an answer to a previous question when the gentleman was asking about the morality of approaching another man's wife. The morality of approaching another man's wife.
Oh, yeah.
Right? If you happen to be in love, and you mentioned the fact about, well, if she was unhappy, etc. Well, he certainly had no knowledge about whether Manavana was unhappy. And I just feel in those three points, really, I just think it makes it a little implausible to give this man an A+ for morality.
Well, I don't want to repeat what I've said about all of those points again. I don't feel that I have anything really substantial to add to what I previously said. So we will simply acknowledge that you don't like some of his actions, but I do not believe that you can use objectivism as a standard to criticize him. So let's just have our impasse stopped at that point. Yes?
When Prince Ivali makes this offer to Manavana, doesn't he then treat Manavana, an honorable woman, as a prostitute?
Does he treat her as a prostitute? No, I don't think so. You're saying a prostitute... I gather there's a fair sentiment against Prince Ivali, is that true? I see by a show of hands, how many are... Not that I'm trying to put you down numerically, but how many are dubious or antagonistic to Prince Ivali for having made this offer? Well, I don't think you have a leg to stand on. I'll just try one last time and then I'll have to conclude the question period here because we're out of our time. Yes, George.
People keep getting up to the forward mics and taking...
All right, I'll answer this in one sentence and take one last question from this...
Thank you.
Well, let me just answer before you get to your question. I've still got the other one dangling. Is she a prostitute? That is an absurd equivocation on language. A prostitute is a woman who has no values and sells her body for money. And this is a woman who has very intense values and is torn by the question whether she should sleep with him in order to save the lives of 30,000 people, including her own. Now, that is a pretty stretched definition of prostitution. I mean, I wouldn't even dignify that by debating it. Now, where was this long-suffering person who wants the last question? Okay, go ahead. Last question, because we're well out over our time. Yeah.
I saw Guido as a concretization of second-hander values, and the characters of Prince Ivali and Monavana and Marco, the father, as being characters of independent values. Wouldn't this explain some of the character motivation and the plot development?
Well, I agree with that entirely. It's a different way of putting it, but you're right. Guido is a second-hander. That's what I tried to suggest by a conventional man. But by calling him a second-hander, you're already imputing to Maeterlinck a degree of psychological profundity that he doesn't have. Second-hander versus first-hander was a concept introduced by Miss Rand in the idea of the way your consciousness works, whether you look first to other people for your psycho-epistemological frame of reference or first to reality and to facts. And these, and it's certainly true that Guido was a second-hander and the others are first-handers. Well, Marco is a little debatable. In some of his moods, he's first-handers, and in some, he's a real compromiser, and in some, he's nothing. He's just a Greek chorus, so he's not a clearly developed character. But the reason I didn't use that language is that I'm trying to present Maeterlinck's characters, and he didn't rise to the point of stressing or making those analyses. I mean, if you wanted to go all the way with it, you could say, Guido, by implication, is not pro-life, and the others are. I mean, that also is part of it, but it's just not presented in those terms. You couldn't say, well, Guido is the equivalent of Jim Taggart. It's just not presented in those terms or on that level. So I was trying to keep the characterization within terms that the playwright would recognize, which is the only reason that I didn't use that terminology. But do I agree with you as an objectivist looking at this play that that is in fact what they represent? Absolutely. But here again, I'm trying to keep separate what an objectivist would say and what the what is in the play for anybody to see whether he's an objectivist or not. Now, I really think we... George, do I have permission to answer another question? Okay.
I agree with you totally that Monavana is not the prostitute. My question last time was, does not Prince Vali treat her as one?
Well, no, he doesn't treat her as a prostitute any more than she is one. He knows that he's in love with her, and that his motive is not to get a cheap titillation. He knows that she's not the kind of person that would engage in love for money, and he knows so thoroughly that he has no plans to sleep with her even if she comes. So to drop all of that context is suggest to me, well, I've already been accused of being improperly antagonistic toward questioners, so I won't say what it suggests to me. But it suggests to me, and I would like to humbly suggest in conclusion of this play that you go back and try to read it without the rule that a marriage is necessarily sacrosanct, and also without the rule that any time a character does something to achieve a value, that is tantamount to selling your body for money. And if you drop those two, you might find that Prince Vali is a better guy than it looks right now. That's it. Thank you very much.